was that many people spoke. There's an interesting point hiding there. One of the things that we would have to encounter in all of these imperial states we've been talking about, in these successions of empire after empire that we've been talking about, how is communication to be affected? How is communication to be affected? What language is everybody going to speak? Well, communications will have been, over long periods of time, a very complicated matter indeed. The Persians took the step of adopting Aramaic, which was a language that large numbers of people would have known at least a little bit, you see? And therefore, communication would have been possible. Just as, for example, later on, Greek, Koine Greek, the common Greek, not the highfalutin Greek of the Attic orators and of Plato and Aristotle, but a common Greek became the language widely used in the Mediterranean world. More widely, actually, than Latin ever was. In the 18th century, French became the language of sort of international communication. Today, obviously, English has become the language of international communication. But in a very real way, in a very long time ago, the Persians had an insight into that process, and so they used the Aramaic language. Now, the Persians built a number of beautiful buildings at their capital at Persepolis, for example. But we think of the Persians particularly, when we think of their culture, in connection with their religious ideas. Now, the chief manifestation of Persian culture, of Persian religion, was what we call Zoroastrianism. Now, this is a rather complicated matter, once again, as with Abraham, as with some of the other religious figures that we'll talk about this term. Scholars dispute the date for Zarathustra, the great teacher of what we call Zoroastrianism. Sometimes you'll hear him referred to as Zoroaster, sometimes Zarathustra, same person. Some would say he goes back perhaps as far as 1000 B.C. Others would say, well, perhaps more like 750. Others would say, well, it's really closer to the time of King Cyrus and the spread of the Persian Empire. In my own view, we probably have something which is actually very old at its origins and then grows and develops and took on new shapes at slightly different points in time. And that as new manifestations of Zoroastrianism appeared, people would tend to attach novelty to them, would attempt to say, this is where the origins are, this is where it all began. And as a result, we get this confused tradition of multiple dates of origin. What we have, as is often the case, is something that is evolving for a long period of time. It's developing over a long period of time. It's really a fool's errand to go and say, that is the moment when it all got started. Now, Zarathustra's teachings are revealed to us in a collection of songs called gathas. Now, the gathas are poems, basically, but the word apparently does mean song more than poem, so it may very well be the case that they were meant to be sung or perhaps intoned, chanted in some way. Okay? The gathas are preserved in a larger work called the Avesta. Now, these are, in a way, the spiritual scriptures of the Zoroastrians, and therefore of the Persian peoples. If we think about this body of material as a whole, the gathas are a part of the Avesta. The gathas, most scholars think, is the section of the Avesta that is particularly to be attributed to Zoroaster, to Zarathustra himself, you see. And the other parts here are parts of the tradition that has emerged over a longer period of time. What did Zarathustra teach? He taught the idea of a single benevolent God, called Ahura Mazda. If any of you are driving a Mazda automobile, you're driving around in a Zoroastrian car. Now, Zarathustra imagined Ahura Mazda to be the single creator of all. In this, of course, Zarathustra is not wholly unlike the Hebrews. But he is most certainly a henotheist or a monolatrist, more than a monotheist. So there is increasing the idea of focusing on a single deity. Zarathustra was also much intrigued by the problem of evil. Well, how many people over long periods of time have been intrigued by the problem of evil? If there is a single God who has made all things and who is somehow benevolent, why is there evil in the world? Why do bad things happen? Can one supreme being at once have created all that is good and all that opposes it? Well, Zarathustra's answer to this question is a rather interesting one. Zarathustra taught that Ahura Mazda had twin children. And after Ahura Mazda's own time, these two children struggled with one another and that world history, in a certain sense, is a playing out of this struggle. The one child is wholly benevolent. The other child is wholly evil. Now, if this begins to sound a little like, for example, the tradition of Satan as a figure who is wholly evil and opposed to another figure, God, who is wholly good, there are certain similarities. I think it would be an exaggeration to say borrowings. I think what we see here is people reflecting in comparable ways to similar phenomena. We have this very interesting problem of imagining a benevolent God and then looking at the world around us. Now, this perpetual struggle between the forces of good and the forces of evil produces a rather interesting way of thinking about the world. And we call this dualism. Now, we meet this dualism for the first time here with the Zoroastrians. We'll meet it later again and again and again. It basically involves us in a series of polarities, good and evil. Sometimes it puts us in a realm of poetic images, light and dark. Sometimes it puts us in a series of emotional images, hope and fear. Sometimes it puts us into a series of spiritual and psychological images, flesh and spirit. St. Paul says the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Well, St. Paul was not a Zoroastrian, but there were certain common ways of talking, certain common ways of thinking. Imagining these polarities